I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate just took a test vote on a bill that would have kept interest rates on student loans low. Republicans blocked the Democratic bill by a vote of 52-45 because they say they object to how the Democrats proposed paying for those low rates by closing loopholes on wealthy stockholders and private S corporations. House Republicans last week passed their version of the bill that will pay for the low rates by cutting a preventative care health fund from the health care law. But Democrats in the Senate oppose that idea. And if lawmakers can't agree on a final bill, interest rates on new student loans are scheduled to double starting July 1st. Kathleen Hunter is Bloomberg News Congress correspondent. She's been at Capitol Hill. Kathleen, as we said, this was just a procedural vote, a test vote. But what does it mean that Republicans voted this bill down?
Well, it's not surprising necessarily that Republicans voted this bill down. As you mentioned, really where the dispute is here is over how to pay for the $6 billion cost of freezing student loan interest rates. That would be interest rates on, you know, federally subsidized Stafford loans, how to freeze those for a year. It's about $6 billion they need to come up with. And has been the case up on Capitol Hill for about a year and a half now. Democrats in the Senate and Republicans in the House can't seem to agree over a way to pay for the one-year freeze. So what we saw today was all of the no Republican support for the Democratic proposal. Republicans have their own proposal, which passed the House, and now I think the real negotiations are going to begin over how and if to really get this done before July 1st.
And we should say this freeze, which has been in effect for a while, freezing rates at about 3%, and they will double to 6%. This would only apply going forward, in other words, for students applying for new loans, but that's a lot of students, something like 7.4 million. Are Republicans nervous about being perceived as holding up low interest rates for students to keep tax breaks for wealthy stockholders?
Definitely. I mean, we've seen what kind of brought this all to a head on Capitol Hill is President Obama, the end of last month, went on a three-state battleground state tour of college campuses where he talked about the need to keep the 3.4% interest rate and on student loans that's currently in place from doubling. If Congress doesn't act, it'll double to 6.8% on July 1st. And once, you know, that kind of lit a fire under Democrats on Capitol Hill who then started talking about bringing up a proposal to keep that rate in place, to keep the lower 3.4% rate in place. And it was really striking because as the president, you know, 2 days after Democrats say they want to do this, the president is still on his three-state tour, and House Speaker John Boehner, a Republican, says, okay, we're going to introduce our own legislation. I think Republicans kind of see what Democrats are doing in terms of the timing of bringing this up. It's certainly an appeal or an attempt by Democrats to appeal to younger voters who came out, you know, two-thirds of people under 30 voted for President Obama in 2008. I think Democrats want to make sure those people come to the polls again, and this is a good talking point for them. And what we see Republicans doing now is Republicans are basically saying, two can play at this game. If you have your proposal to freeze student loan rates, we agree with the idea of freezing them. So we're gonna introduce our own proposal to do just that, and then we can argue over the particularities of how to pay for it.
On the other hand, Kate, are you hearing that there is wiggle room? Is there room? This is not a compromising Congress. Is there room for compromise?
Well, it definitely isn't a compromising Congress, but I did talk with Senator Tom Harkin earlier today, right before the vote, and he's the chairman of the Senate committee that handles education issues. And he said that basically the quote was, obviously Democrats aren't going to let this die. He said, we'll definitely find a way to work something out before July 1st. So I don't think that, you know, this is something that Democrats want to see go unresolved. I think that quite often, especially here in the Senate, where it takes 60 votes to get anything done, what we see is each side sort of puts out their opening negotiating point, and then once those are voted down, then the real negotiations over how to find a solution, how to pay for this. This is the time when those negotiations will probably begin.
That's Kathleen Hunter, Bloomberg News Congress correspondent on Capitol Hill, where the Senate Republicans have just voted down a Democratic proposal for keeping student loan rates low. And now they go back at it. Kathleen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There have been a lot of provocative issues brought up in the run-up to the November elections. Insurance coverage for contraception. Last month, the Vatican admonished a group of progressive nuns, in part because they supported the health care law. And some of the Republican candidates, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, both Catholics, said their faith was under attack. Well, the U.S. Conference of Bishops would agree with them. Last month, the group called for 2 weeks of public protests starting in late June against what it sees as growing government encroachment on religious freedom. We tried to get to someone from the conference. We were not given someone to speak with. But we want to know, why do some Catholics feel oppressed? So we're going to start today with William Donahue. He's president of the Catholic League. He's independent of the Vatican, although his group is listed in the official Catholic directory. And he supports the bishops. The New York Times calls Mr. Donahue the professional wrestler of the Catholic right wing. Bill, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And do you feel like you're in a wrestling match? And if so, you know, what are you wrestling? Why are you under attack?
Well, I wrestle sometimes with my fellow Catholics and often with people who are outside the religion.
What are the issues that you are concerned about and why?
Well, for example, never before in the history of America have we ever had the federal government define a religion as so narrowly as the Obama administration, which says that a religion, in order to have exemptions, you have to serve and hire people only of your own faith. That's kind of a little too cute by half. Catholic Church, one of the great strengths of it is that when it comes to hospitals and schools, to take two examples, we don't ask people, are you Catholic? We serve you.
This is the debate over the health care law. The Obama administration gave an exemption to Catholic churches, for instance, that to hire people
right.
of the faith, but said that hospitals, for instance, that hire people outside of the faith had to have coverage for
schools,
contraception.
Universities,
yeah,
right,
yeah, in the health plans. But then they gave a concession when there was a response to this. They said that Catholic institutions like hospitals and universities, it would be their insurance company that would be responsible for covering contraception. It would be taken away from the actual hospital. People feel that that was compromised.
See, I don't think it was. Let me just give you my own example. We're the Catholic League, and our insurance carrier is Christian Brothers. Christian Brothers is a Catholic insurance carrier. Where do they get the money to cover the insurance? Well, they get it from the Catholic League, from the employees. So this is just a shell game. It doesn't resolve anything.
You make a point, and yet Catholics overwhelmingly in polling were very happy with what they saw as a compromise. And as you said, you were wrestling with people in your own church. James Salt, executive director of the Catholics United group, told the Hill paper that his group feels Catholics aren't oppressed, that their positioning in society is greater than their numbers. There are six Catholic members of the Supreme Court. It doesn't feel that Catholics are oppressed.
As far as James Salt is concerned, I don't have any reply. It's a George Soros-funded organization, so he doesn't really count as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we know that you support the U.S. Conference of Bishops call for
yes.
this public protest in June and July. Tell us more about why. What are some of the issues that disturb you?
Well, I mean, the Obama administration has hired one anti-Catholic after another. They have a person who's directing them on this, Kathleen Sebelius.
Well, she is Catholic.
Well, we don't know that. She's been totally in violation of Catholic teaching for a long time, so arguably she has already excommunicated herself.
Well, so this is your view. They would obviously have a different one. Do you understand there are people who say that they love the Catholic Church as much as you do, and yet they are interpreting things differently? I'm thinking of the Nuns Group, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. The Vatican again said they were promoting radical feminism because they supported the Obama health care law. One of the sisters who is in support says it to her, she's following Jesus' mandate to help the lepers. I mean, she sees herself as an avowed Catholic.
We have a magisterium in the Catholic Church. That's the Pope in communion with the bishops. And they are the official teaching body. Now, people may say, oh, I'm a Catholic in good standing, but I'm pro-abortion. Well, that's an oxymoron. And that's the problem with a lot of these nuns. You know, there are certain things in the Catholic Church, such as abortion, slavery, euthanasia, racism, which are regarded as intrinsically evil. And so, therefore, there's no wiggle room. The reason they've been called on the carpet is precisely because for decades, we've had nuns who have basically been more interested in New Ageism and have totally lost the faith. And no one wants to speak about people like the Sisters of Life and all the other good nuns who are not in open rebellion against the Catholic Church. And I think that's the real sham. You have a group, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, only 3%. Of the nuns in the United States of America belong to this organization, and they act as if they're speaking for all sisters.
Actually, we heard the statistic was 80%. 80% of the American nuns belong to this
but
group.
They don't pay any dues.
I'm not going to quibble over the numbers, but I hear what you're saying, and yet you listed the things the church stands for. Isn't the death penalty also something the church is against?
The church regards the death penalty to be presumptively evil.
So do you go after politicians who support the death penalty?
I don't know too many of them who do.
Rick Santorum, for instance, does support the death penalty. He has for a long time. Has your group taken that up as a concern?
No, as I say, because children are being killed in the womb every day in this country by the thousands. What do we kill in capital punishment? Do we even do one a year?
You know, we understand that the Conference of Bishops is calling for this protest coming up in large part because of government encroachment. But what it sounds like I'm hearing is a schism within the church. The Guttmacher Institute says that 98% of Catholic women have used birth control. These are women filling the pews.
Actually, they walked that figure back. Let's just say it's 90%, just for the sake
of
argument.
Okay.
My question is, so what? Catholic Church is against lying. Catholics lie every day. And some of them are murderers and rapists, for that matter. But the question is this. Should the federal government have the authority to encroach itself and tell Catholics that in Catholic organizations that they have to fund abortion-inducing drugs? That's what's on the table.
Well, we're going to move on to just one last topic while we have you. You've spoken out against the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. This is the group called SNAP. It's a network of volunteers victimized by Catholic priests. You recently said SNAP is a menace to the Catholic Church. Are they not strengthening the church by pointing out its flaws so that they can be healed?
There's a profound difference between somebody who's a legitimate, proven victim, and those people deserve all the justice in the world, and SNAP, which claims to represent them. I sent people undercover into the annual conference. The hatred of the Catholic Church that comes from SNAP is would make your head reel. And so, no, I regard this as a phony anti-Catholic organization. It may have started out well, but let's please not conflate anybody's sympathies for people who have been truly victimized with SNAP.
Other people have confirmed the victimization of members of SNAP. They say that the church is trying to destroy them by subpoenaing them to give up information about other victims. The bishops deny this, by the way, but do you think that there is a move to do this and that there should be?
People like myself have been saying for years that the bishops have been too tolerant. Look, I want to pick up something you just recently said. You said, you know, this seems like an intra-church battle.
Yeah.
Well, it is, which makes me wonder, why do we have all these voyeurs looking into the Catholic Church who are not Catholic? Does anybody go in there and make comments about Judaism? Do they speak about Islam?
One answer might be that Catholics have tried to affect policy that affects everyone.
Well, the question is this. Should religious institutions have the kind of autonomy that they've had for a couple of hundred years, or should we now switch because we have people like Kathleen Sebelius and President Obama who think that they want the state to eclipse the authority of religious institutions?
Well, William Donahue, we are going to have to leave it on that note.
All right.
Bill Donahue, president of the Catholic League. No, we're up against a break. When we come back, how many Catholics does he represent? Is it you? Let us know. HereAndNow.org. Welcome back to our conversation about Catholics. Bishops are calling for Catholics to protest government encroachment this June over issues like contraception and gay marriage. The Vatican recently reprimanded a nuns group for their support of the health care law. But this week, a Catholic vice president supported gay marriage, and a recent Pew poll shows 52% of Catholics agree with him, more than the 46% of Americans that support gay marriage. We just heard from William Donahue of the far-right Catholic League. He says Catholics are oppressed. So now let's bring in John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter. John, how many Catholics is Bill speaking for?
He represents a kind of strongly conservative current in the Catholic Church in the United States that you could probably estimate at around, say, 25% of the broader Catholic population. Bear in mind, there are 67 million Catholics in America. That's about a quarter of the national population. There's probably equally about 25% or so of the Catholic population that would be on the left, and then you've got this overwhelming majority clustered in the middle who would listen to the interview that you just did with Bill Donahue and would find themselves agreeing with some points and perhaps rolling their eyes at others.
For instance, we heard him say that he felt that SNAP, this is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, he says there is a move to destroy them, and there should be. He has also been quoted as saying the church has been too quick to write a check. I think the church has now realized it would be a lot less expensive in the long run if we fought them one by one. What do most Catholics think about these survivors networks who have helped root out what is real sexual abuse in the Catholic Church?
My sense of sentiment at the Catholic grassroots would certainly be that there is overwhelming sympathy for the victims of sexual abuse by the clergy and an overwhelming desire that justice be done to them. Now, in terms of that debate about stamp, I do think that there are some who think that there's almost nothing the church could do that would fully satisfy them. And so I think Bill is to some extent articulating real concerns. But I think how those concerns translate into policy, that is, whether the church ought to be pursuing a program of aggressive litigation to fight back, there I think you would get significant disagreement.
Well, especially as we're watching a trial in Philadelphia of Monsignor Lynn, a former secretary of the clergy who's being accused of covering up priest abuse, and the Archdiocese in Philadelphia just announcing the result of its own investigation, finding several priests unsuitable for ministry. So this is, you know, a very real thing. You know, John Allen, some of the Catholics that we work with have said to ask you, you talk about this conservative strain. When did this happen? When was the church represented by an almost evangelical Catholic like Rick Santorum, as opposed to, let's say, Father Drynan, who seemed to be the face of the church for so long, someone much more dedicated to social justice?
I think the big picture is that in the United States, at least, beginning in the late 19th century, the Catholic population tend to be overwhelmingly immigrant, blue-collar, ethnic, and over time that naturally translated into support, basically, for the Democratic Party. That was combined in the mid-1960s with something called the Second Vatican Council, which unleashed a lot of reform energies in the church, and in particular, I think, galvanized the progressive wing of the church. And in the center of gravity in the Catholic Church seemed to be on the social justice end of things, workers' rights, healthcare reform. The high watermark of that probably came in the 80s, and then I think there were some who were concerned that core elements of Catholic faith and practice were being watered down. And that tended to produce the rise of sort of a new generation, both of bishops within the church and also public figures outside the church, who were a bit more conservative. Now, it's not that the elements in Catholicism that somebody like Father Bob Drynan, the great Jesuit, who was a member of Congress for a while, it's not that those elements have gone away. But I do think we're living through a moment in which the center right to the right has the upper hand. Now that the church seems to be moving more to the right, that's producing a sharp liberal backlash. And I think we're seeing that play out across a variety of fronts. I think the tensions within the Catholic community about how do you engage the Obama administration, and particularly the controversy over the contraceptive mandates, would be one front. I think the current crackdown on the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which is the main umbrella group for the superiors of women's orders in the states, that would be another front, and there will undoubtedly be others. I think it is quite clear that on all of these issues, there is a much broader spread of Catholic opinion at the grassroots than you get when you focus exclusively on the top of the church.
And this is the Catholic Church, where the leadership counts far more than one could say in some other churches. But what do you see happening here? I've spoken to many Catholics who see themselves as devout Catholics, but don't see their church leadership as God's, as maybe their parents did.
Well, I think one of the real strengths of American Catholicism is that it tends to be very parochial in the best sense of the term. That is, most American Catholics, when they think about the church, tend to think much more about their local parish than they do about the broader national scene or what's happening in Rome. So I think these tensions are certainly going to go on. I think there are undoubtedly going to be some Catholics who choose to walk away, but I don't see sort of mass defections either on the left or the right, depending on where the church goes in the future, precisely because we have this shock absorber in American Catholic life of religion, like politics, being mostly local.
Well, and just one last thought. Bill Donahue asked, why are we focusing on Catholics? And of course we are, because the issue of Catholicism intersects with policy. And we're reading 62% of devout Catholics favor Mitt Romney as a presidential candidate. 54% of non-religious Catholics favor President Obama. So predictable schism there. Do you think that Catholics will play a role in this election?
Well, I think Catholics always play a role in any American election, but overall, you can usually take it for granted that in any presidential election in advance, about 45% of Catholics are going to vote for the Democrat no matter what. About 45% are going to vote for the Republican no matter what. So the game is always for that 10% in the middle. And it's going to be very interesting to watch the competing political strategies of those two candidates as they try to reach that small but critically significant pool of Catholics in the middle, who, of course, tend to be overwhelmingly concentrated in battleground states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Texas, and so on, where success or failure in any presidential campaign is often determined.
John Allen, reporter for the National Catholic Reporter. John, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Nearly a dozen Democrats and Republicans are running in party primaries in Maine next month to replace that state's longtime and famously centrist Republican Senator Olympia Snowe. You remember a few months back, she pointedly said she's not seeking re-election because of the bitter political divide in Washington. Well, up in Maine, pretty much everyone who's running to replace Senator Snowe is campaigning against one man, the independent, popular, former two-term governor of Maine, Angus King, a self-made millionaire, alternative energy mogul, and lawyer who famously traveled cross-country in his RV after he left office in 2003. We spoke to him at that time. And if Angus King is elected, he could swing the balance of power in what's expected to be a closely or perhaps evenly divided Senate next year by choosing which party he wants to vote with. Remember, he's independent. Joining us is Maine Public Broadcasting's A.J. Higgins, longtime watcher of all things political in Maine. And A.J., with an eye on that, with the fact that, you know, Angus King is very aware that he is an independent, he shot a salvo out to, you know, the super PACs and national campaigns who might get involved here. He said, I'm going to take note of how I'm treated in this campaign. You know, flesh that out. What did he mean?
I think that what you're going to see from our former governor, who is going to probably wage a fairly, aggressive campaign for the U.S. Senate, is that we recently saw in our previous election cycle an influx of Republican money into Maine that really fueled some significant negative advertising against Democrats. And as a result, Republicans were able to claim majorities in both the Maine House and the Maine Senate. I think that you will see that Angus King has the ability and the backing to be able to fight back if, in fact, he finds himself on the receiving end of similar types of right. PAC spending on ads that he would perceive as being negative and unfair.
Well, I'm guessing it's not just that. You know, he has that vote. It could be the vote that is the swing vote in the Senate because he's the independent, and he hasn't said who he'd support for Senate Majority Leader. The subtext of his comment, meaning, you know, you beat up on me too much, I may not vote for you, either Republicans or Democrats. Meanwhile, here's what Maine's current Republican governor, conservative Paula Page, said at the party convention this past weekend about Angus King accepting $102 million in federal stimulus program loan guarantees for a wind power company he founded after leaving office.
We all know Angus King. He wants to be a U.S. senator. But before the media coronates him, let me do it. Angus King is the king of the wind cartel. Yes, he's likable, but let's not forget that he has made a fortune off your backs.
So, A.J. Higgins, apparently the current governor did not get the memo about not attacking Angus King because he might be a swing vote in Congress. It sounds like it's going to be, you know, a tough fight.
Yeah, he's taken point on that issue in a way that other Republicans have not. Our governor tends to be plain spoken and isn't afraid to speak his mind, as you've probably heard. So it's not surprising that he would take that particular tone. However, I've been informed by members of King's staff that within 30 days, Angus King's financial reports will have to be filed with the FEC, and I'm told that as the result of those reports become known, it should provide something of an eye-opening experience to Governor Paul LePage.
The man has done well, but he has a 62% approval rate there up in Maine. We're going to keep a close eye on this as suddenly Maine, with Angus King jumping into the race, becomes a very pivotal Senate race. And A.J. Higgins, again, State House Bureau Chief for the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, we will be calling you again. Thank you.
You too.
Sounds of celebrations over the weekend in Tokyo as the last of Japan's 50 nuclear reactors was switched off, the first time in 40 years that Japan is without nuclear power. And questions are being raised as to whether it's going to ever have it again. Most of the shutdowns were for inspections, but there's huge mistrust of the government and the nuclear industry because of last year's meltdown at Fukushima. So will the reactors come back? Where will the Japanese get power in the meantime? Will there be brownouts in the months ahead? Michael Friedlander is the former nuclear power plant operator here in the U.S. You remember we spoke with him several times during the Fukushima crisis. He joins us from Hong Kong. So, Michael, what were you thinking as you watched this complete shutdown in Japan?
Well, you know, it wasn't a big surprise to me, and I think that it is largely symbolic of really the situation where the public has lost just complete faith and trust, not only in the industry, but in the regulatory environment as well as the political environment. And sadly, I think that's not going to change anytime soon.
Well, some of the reactors were destroyed in the Fukushima meltdown, but these others are being inspected. You know, meanwhile, Japan gets about a third of its electricity from nuclear power. How are they going to fill that gap, you know, even just in the interim?
That's, in fact, the trillion yen question. So basically, they're left with only really a handful of options. Of course, the first and the cheapest and the best option is conservation. And there have been a whole host of initiatives underway by the government and by the electric utilities to really promote as much as they can conservation. But unfortunately, particularly for TEPCO and for the Kansai Electric utilities, those are the two biggest and the ones that were most committed to nuclear, conservation is not going to cut it. And so what those two utilities are left with and the rest of the companies in Japan, they're going to have to take some old thermal power plants that were in mothball state and take them out of mothball, which they have been doing over the course of the last year. And finally, I'm afraid that at least in the TEPCO service area and in the Kansai Electric service area, depending upon how warm the summer is, there's really a very good chance that there's going to be forced curtailments over the course of the summer.
And by the way, remind us, thermal power?
These are conventional fired power plants that are powered by LNG, coal, and low grades of residual fuel oil. And those power plants will be taken out of mothball status as much as they can and put back into service.
Replacing the nuclear. Well, we know the government in Japan is worried about that because, of course, they're concerned about fossil fuels and pollution. But as you said, the people are pushing back, not just people, but local politicians are pushing back. And it seems as if companies have their eye on that horizon as well. Two Japanese companies, Mitsubishi and Mitsui, have bought a $2 billion share in a liquefied natural gas project in Australia. This happened last week. So obviously companies want to be prepared in case nuclear power doesn't come back.
Certainly. I don't expect that this is going to change anytime soon. So really, the companies are only left with a few alternatives.
Yeah.
And LNG is probably the quickest and the cheapest and most efficient option.
But, you know, I mean, other countries have done this. Germany, for instance, has outlawed, you know, nuclear power. But can Japan do that? It's isolated. It's on an island. You know, that's one of the issues. It went nuclear in the first place. It seems like it's one of the harder places to ship all of this stuff to.
You know, it remains to be seen. It was easy for Germany to pass the resolution. Basically, they just set a time horizon out in, you know, the next decade where the power plants will be shut down and not restarted. You know, economic growth is largely dependent upon an abundant and cheap supply of electrical energy. So, you know, at the moment when the public is faced with the pain of not having electricity or going into economic recession or faced with the pain of restarting nuclear power plants, we'll see what happens. One of the issues besides the curtailments, of course, is the stability of the grid. We've seen that in the U.S. You remember in 2003, the massive power blackout that was in northeastern United States. And when the grid is operating with very, very, very low levels of spinning reserve, a simple disturbance as a lightning strike or a substation that switches off can propagate a massive fault across the electrical system. And so it's not only an issue of rolling blackouts, it's an issue of the grid stability across the entire country.
Because as you say, without a lot of energy in reserve, one little thing can bring down the whole system.
Exactly.
Well, there are now about 60 nuclear reactors under construction around the world, most in China. The U.S. has plans to build more. Are those countries watching Japan, or is Japan such an isolated situation? I mean, in other words, if Japan decides, if the public pressure is such that Japan does not go back online or really delays bringing these reactors back online, is that going to impact the industry in the rest of the world?
The decision to utilize the nuclear technology is really something that occurs at a local level. Even in Japan, as we've seen, even though it's a national decision, it's really up to the local authorities as to whether or not they are going to permit a nuclear power plant to operate in their service territory. But I think what you're going to see is, particularly in the developing countries like China and other countries in Southeast Asia, I think that they are committed to the nuclear technology.
So we will not have a chilling effect, is what you're saying. And you know, as Japan considers bringing these reactors back, we saw, almost a core meltdown. Are they going to rebuild them, build them differently as they bring them back?
I've gone on record before saying that, and I believe this with every fiber of my being. There are nuclear technologies that are more forgiving of upset situations. You know, these were second-generation nuclear power plants. There are third-generation nuclear power plants being built. There's, of course, a whole number of things that you can do in terms of engineered safety features. But at the end of the day, it's not about the technology. At the end of the day, it's about the people and the institutions that are operating these facilities. I can take a fourth-generation, brand-new nuclear power plant and put it in the hands of an incompetent regulatory environment and an incompetent nuclear operator, and I can create just as much or more damage than these early second-generation nuclear power plants. So that's what it's about. Certainly there will be retrofits. Certainly there will be changes made, all which will enhance nuclear safety. But at the end of the day, until the attitude and beliefs of the nuclear operators and the nuclear regulatory oversight authorities in Japan, until that changes, they don't deserve to be operating nuclear power plants. Since last fall, the nuclear oversight institution in Japan, they were supposed to completely separate it from the group within the government that promotes nuclear power. So the regulator and the promoter were supposed to be split and a brand new agency set up. That still has not happened. You know, a complete metamorphosis in the way the nuclear electric utilities operate in their view of safety. Right now, they're just obsessed with performing these stress tests. It's not about the stress tests. It's about emergency planning, emergency preparation, and training and qualifying the nuclear operators. Until all of that happens, they're no safer today than they were in March of last year.
Michael Friedlander, former nuclear power plant operator in the U.S., now quite an expert on the industry, speaking to us from Hong Kong. Michael, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we lost a great storyteller today. Maurice Sendak died early this morning in Danbury, Connecticut at 83 after writing more than 100 books in his 60-year career. A few favorites, Chicken Soup with Rice, about the boy who sings a rhyming song for every month of the year. In the Night Kitchen, another boy falls out of bed and into cake batter in a fantastical kitchen run by three Oliver Hardy look-alike bakers. And, of course, the 1964 classic Where the Wild Things Are, about the night little Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another.
So he was sent to bed without eating anything. That very night, in Max's room, a forest grew. And grew.
That book earned Maurice Sendak both acclaim and controversy. It was thought his stories were too dark for children. We spoke to him in 2008. In his honor, we present excerpts from that conversation again. We began by asking where the wild things are came from.
Well, that comes from our relatives. All the wild things are relatives who were brought over by my parents during World War II when they were trying to get Jewish people out of Europe. And these are the ones in my mother's family, because that's what my father thought appropriate. And he got most of her siblings out and her mother, but that was it. And when he turned to his own family, they were gone.
Oh. Well, how much of the storytelling is about that, you know, about taming the monsters by looking in their eyes?
Well, yes, I have never claimed to be a writer of children's books. I wrote honestly. I wrote about my life. I wrote about what was happening. There were many bleak, dark moments. I wanted to be very, very honest. I also knew that the worst thing you can do to children is lie and not appreciate the fact that the truth, no matter how painful, is more acceptable to them than some nonsense story. And I've gotten in trouble over that in terms of some of the books I did. Some people thought the Wild Things were too frightening. I've tried not to care about that because, as I said, I didn't set myself out to write books for children or to make life easier or charming or funny. If it is, it is, and sometimes it is funny. But I'm a writer and an illustrator, and I take my work seriously.
Should we look for these references in other stories? For instance, you know, I'm thinking of Mickey, the little boy in the night kitchen, a personal favorite, falls out of bed, as we said, past his mom, into the cake batter in the night kitchen. But I can't help but notice now that he narrowly escapes the oven. You know, he was going to be baked.
And you got it.
Oh, really?
You got it. And did you notice the bakers have little Hitler mustachios?
I do now.
Yep.
Yeah. And he makes his way out by making a plane out of bread dough. Now that breaks my heart.
No? Well, don't let it break your heart. Continue to enjoy the book. But I think it thickens and makes more profound, if I dare use that word, the work in hand. That it comes from those sources. I grew up during all of that. I was born just at the beginning of it, and I had to see what sufferings my parents went through. It was not to be believed.
Yeah. Your biographer, the playwright Tony Kushner, he writes that you suffer a book rather than write one. You suffer a book.
I think under pressure, he would have to admit that he suffers a play.
Yeah, but yours are supposed to be children's books, but you've revealed to us what you know, part of what you're bringing to the table. And we understand, you know, so hard at times that you actually suffered a nervous breakdown doing Outside Over There.
Correct.
Why? What was...
I don't know. The book was of an extremely personal nature. My sister was in it. Mozart was in it. Important people in my life were in that book. And it brought me low. It brought me low because it probably touched on very deep unconscious things that the artist, of course, is always struggling to bring up.
Yeah.
And put down on paper and solve and win.
It's laid out like a children's storybook with beautiful illustrations, but it tells of an infant who gets kidnapped by goblins and how big sister Ida must go find the baby outside over there. And Maurice Sendak, I'm thinking of how your mother was able to save her siblings from outside over there, but your father couldn't.
Yeah. See, that was always an immensely fascinating place for me. Because that's where they came from. They did get my grandmother. The only grandparent I have is my mother's mother. And the stories she told were so frightening, were so chilling. Jewish people in tiny villages where nobody wanted them. And so they were not the cheerful stories. I didn't grow up on Robin Hood. I didn't grow up on Oz. So to be sad and quiet, I'm afraid, was what childhood was like.
Well, and then you add to that, you say it was in part inspired by the 1932 Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which probably terrified a lot of children.
Oh, well, correct. I mean, that was just about the worst that could happen. And so it was no way that childhood could be some Winnie the Pooh nonsense.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to be fortunate enough to be Christopher Robin. Fate put me where it put me, and it put a lot of kids in much worse conditions than I was in. But it leaves this big, fat handprint on you.
Yeah. Well, we rush to say, too, that if you don't read it with that backstory, I mean, even if you do, I mean, we have so much fun in the night kitchen, you know, making dough into an airplane and falling in a milk bottle.
Well, you see, it's a funny idea. I loved it. I thought it was such a funny idea. And it made me remember my mother, who made marvelous cookies, and they came out all different shapes. That the other things creep in is something I can't prevent.
And when I see Where the Wild Things Are today, I see Shrek. I see, what was that, Monsters, Inc., where the little boy goes through the wall? I see all of those monsters that aren't really monsters.
Well, I think I can say this honestly without sounding vain. You wouldn't have seen them pre-Wild Things.
Yeah.
Wild Things did break the wall. It did come out and say there were such things as nightmares and creatures that children had to contend with, that adults have to contend with. And yet, I don't want to make light of that fear, because how could we not be fearful for our children? So even if sometimes, you know, I get annoyed that somebody thinks something of mine is too frightening for their kid, well, then I always just tell them, don't read it. Because some things are. There are some who just will be frightened at anything. Often they change those conclusions later. It's nice. In the old days when I would be at college and some person would shake my hand firmly and say, boy, that book really scared me as a kid, but I just love it now. And that's great. That's what art is. We learn.